a real conversation and some hard truths. Gangs, drugs, and guns. Giving a voice to those willing to sacrifice. We have stories that need to be told. We have lessons that need to be taught. Protect and serve. Welcome to The Quiet Professional.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Nathan Romas with you. Today, we have quite a few topics I think we're going to get to, but the big ones being insurance, the insurance industry, investigations, and some stuff on open source work. For that, I have Liz Pia on the program. Liz is a senior investigative consultant with W3 Intelligence Research Group Incorporated. Liz has over 26 years experience working with major insurers and legal teams, specializing in fraud investigations, catastrophic injury, and dispute resolution. Liz has worked in senior management positions with State Farm Insurance, CAA Insurance Company, and TD Bank. And now with W3, Liz consults with insurance companies, financial institutions, law firms, and police on fraud and risk management using utilizing social media and open source investigations. And these investigations focus on things like insurance fraud, transnational organized crime schemes, asset forfeiture, and human trafficking. Some of those are really big topics. So hopefully we can break it down for people what those mean. But welcome, Liz.
Thank you. Thank you, Nathan, so much. I'm really honored to be on your show.
Oh, well, thank you. One thing I wanted to start with was, where's your last name from? What's the background?
Italian.
Oh, okay. I was thinking, I'm like, I thought it was like maybe South American or something, but yeah, no.
Said that a lot.
Very unique name. I don't think I've ever run into another Pia.
Typically, a lot of people call me Pia first, and so I have to correct them. My name is Liz, by the way. it's a very nice, pretty name.
Yeah. Well, one thing we'll start with is just talking a bit about you. If you kind of run us through a bit of your background and tell us how you got to where you are today with W3.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I actually wanted to, or I aspired to be a police officer when I was a teenager. And pretty much around the age of about 14, 15 years old, my father always encouraged me to go to university, take a criminology course. So as I was getting closer to my grade 11 courses, that was, you know, a pivotal moment for me. But I couldn't afford university. My parents were separated at the time. And my mom actually, she was living in Ottawa and we were in Toronto. So she worked for the Minister of State Finance. She was actually the assistant to the Minister of State Finance. So I wasn't able to afford university. So I applied as a cadet when I was 19. And it was such an incredible time for me, being someone not receiving the mentorship that I probably needed. But I applied to Toronto Police. And I knew that my passion was probably public safety. My focus was a real interest in drug trafficking.
Okay.
So I probably should have researched other areas of maybe fraud, but I actually passed all the courses, which was fantastic. I'm a bit short, so it's 5'2", so I was a little bit concerned about whether or not I could get in, first of all, as a female back in the 80s. Basically, I passed, like I said, the courses, got down to the interview, and I was interviewed by two detectives. And that was very challenging. Hmm. So at that point, that was the point where it was, I didn't get in. But when I was counseled by just the college, he goes, Liz, you've got what it takes to become a police officer. And I think what you should do is apply for or even go into law enforcement and go into the applied courses. He recommended a number of colleges, but I ended up choosing Seneca College. And I took the law, back then it was called law enforcement.
Okay.
It's well, police foundations. So within my 2 years of being at Seneca, within less than the first year, I knew I did not want to become a police officer, or I didn't want to get into security. And that's pretty much all that they had, the course offered was a, you know, you're geared to become a police officer or go into
security. I was going to ask, why was that though? Like, what made you think that or realize that?
From the beginning, pretty much at my course. I felt, I'm going to be completely honest, I felt it was a male-dominated industry.
Okay.
And I knew my strengths, but I knew that I would probably be taken down, no problem, by individuals or bad actors or criminals. And I probably wouldn't survive the first year.
Okay.
So the discussion was that I would be placed in a location at the Jane and Finch area. I don't know if you're familiar with Jane and Finch.
Yeah. By name. Yeah.
Okay. So I used to live on Driftwood and in that area. And it's at that time it was heavily infested with criminal activity.
Yeah.
So I knew firsthand that I would not make it out alive. So I'm being very honest in that respect. But I was never one to give up. I figured I'm gonna continue the course. I'm not gonna back out of the course. And I ended up graduating with honors, which I was really happy about. And on career day, which was really pivotal, was there were all the law enforcement agencies there. Which was really cool because it was including RCMP, OPP was there, all your local police services. And then there was one insurance company that was there, and that was State Farm Insurance. And he was a manager at the time. And he literally stood up to the students. And there were about 100, I would say about 200 students. And he sold it. Like you could tell he was a salesperson. And then when I found out a little bit later, he was actually in the car business previous to his insurance, insurance profession. And his name is Rick Fleury. And so Rick explained, he goes, I'm looking for someone who is passionate about their job and wants to protect people and wants to get out there and do scene investigations. Contact police, interview various individuals, understand what fraud is all about in the insurance world. But he explained it in great detail. And that was great for me. So I knew I actually stood in line. There were 150 of us that applied and only two got hired. So myself in the Markham, it was really cool, in the Markham area and another individual in the Burlington area. And in 1989, so I graduated law enforcement in 1989, and I started literally 2 weeks later. So
that's good.
Because the interview was quite extensive. They're, you know, typical panel of, you know, 3 to 5 people sort of thing. So I was really pleasantly surprised that I got the job. Rick Fleury, I would say, was my first mentor. He was fantastic. He knew insurance crime, insurance fraud inside and out. He managed numerous teams, and he was quite influential to a number of us. There were a number, we were called adjusters at the time, which they still refer to insurance professionals as adjusters. He took so much time to develop us and threw us out into the, you know, as like we're sharks, or sorry, threw us out like fish into a shark's pool sort of thing. And we would have to go and we would have to interview. We would have a company car and we would have to do kind of drive-bys to see whether or not the employment was legitimate, because there was a lot of fraud that was going on in the 80s.
Okay.
And full circle, it's still happening today, and it's been happening all the time. So from there, I really developed my skill set with insurance. Funny enough, Rick, even though I was on, the team is called the bodily injury team. So when you get into a car accident, you're injured, You sue the other party because you're not at fault. I was on that team, the bodily injury team, but Rick saw qualities in me that I didn't even know I had when I was in my early 20s. And he said, you have empathy. You have compassion to see someone through a real car accident and someone who is injured, legitimately injured. And I think you would be best in suited for a role in rehabilitation. And I actually didn't want to do it. I didn't want that. I didn't want to be an accident benefit adjuster, as they called it. I really liked working with the guys that I worked with. And there was such a great camaraderie amongst us. A lot of them were football fans, so which was really cool into football, football plays and stuff like that. But I took Rick's advice because I trusted him. And I then ended up doing a rehabilitation course. And I really loved getting people who suffered serious injuries, legitimate injuries, and getting them back to work and going through the whole rehabilitation process with them. So I ended up leaving State Farm. I stayed there for about 5 years, and then I went on to CAA Insurance, which is our Canadian Automobile Association.
Yeah.
So in the States, it's AAA. So I entered into CAA in 1993, and as a kind of a senior accident benefit adjuster, but primarily only handling catastrophic injury. So some of my worst cases were serious brain injury, where an individual either is hit by as a pedestrian or they're in a serious car accident where the vehicle's total. I've had, you know, minors who have been involved in go-kart accidents. Her injury, well, her fatality, she was decapitated. So things like that really drove me to want to learn more, develop my skill set, get people back to work. But I still had that desire and passion about combating fraud. Like that was my whole premise of getting into insurance, was tackling the insurance fraud that was going on. So I managed to actually become a leader very quickly at CAA Insurance. And I managed a number of teams, but so that was in the 90s. And then the time that I actually really enjoyed working, and it was probably my most important time, was working in litigation. So we had a litigation team. I had a number of consultants. They were called consultants. And we would basically work with counsel.
Okay.
So our defense counsel on just being, you know, sued in the industry, or you know, we're taking a claim and we're either going to pay it or we're not going to pay it. So, but with that, at that point in time, there was still a need for special investigations. So I'm going to actually shout out to a number of my bosses, because if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be where I am today. So Carolyn Della Camera, she saw the strength that I had, and also the tenacity to build a team. And so we developed the Special Investigations Unit at CAA in 2005. We were getting hit so hard with insurance fraud, not only us, but numerous insurance companies, large ones that you would know today. So
I just want to jump in too. So when you talk about getting hit with insurance fraud, is this like organized crime side of things, or is this like just individuals just putting in bogus complaints?
Yeah, I would say it's everything like that. So someone who will embellish a claim, that kind of like your soft type of fraud, to the organized crime. And then when I explain a story that or an investigation that we went through, it was definitely transnational organized crime. So that I think is important to understand, is every insurance company has to have a specialized investigation unit, because fraud is rampant throughout.
Yeah.
Um, I was fortunate enough to continue with my litigation team. So I had four consultants, and I'm gonna shout out to them because they are instrumental to me just on how we moved to actually assist CAA in lessening the fraud and being a target. So I'm going to shout out to Anthony Sequeira. He's now a director at TTC in legal.
Okay.
Nathan Hall, he's actually, I believe he's also a director at Intact. Jason Osborne works with Anthony at TTC. And John Mendez Curia is still at CAA Insurance as a leader as well. So we formed this team, but we could not do it on our own. We actually had to hire former detectives. So we collaborated as a team, consulted with our leadership team, and we said, you know, we need the expertise of law enforcement. And then we hired four former detectives who actually worked for Toronto Police. We had to, Nathan, we had to actually train them on insurance, the Insurance Act. They needed to know a claim inside out from start to finish, and they had to understand what policy meant. So
I was just saying, I don't think a lot of people realize how many police, once they retire, a lot of people do jump to the banking world, insurance world. There's a lot of stuff when it comes to like claims and the fraud that police have like kind of a different perspective on, I guess, or a unique perspective. So yeah, a lot of people do make that transition.
Yeah. And there's, I would say, for SIU, we're pretty much hiring former law enforcement. So I think it's really key to have an understanding if you're currently in law enforcement, that there's so much opportunity out there. And I've actually mentored a number of individuals, police officers or even detectives that are interested in making the move to insurance. Mm-hmm. So I'm available to have that discussion as well. But it was great. So they did all the kind of the on-scene type of investigation. They went to the clinics. They interviewed practitioners. They did the investigation to see whether or not the practitioners were legitimate or not. The employment, many of them did not have a lot of the employment forms that they would fill out was fraudulent.
Wow.
There was a lot of identity that was going on. Yeah.
So. So now you're with W3, so you're on the outside of the insurance industry, but still work with them as partners?
Yeah. So what I, from CAA Insurance, I actually went to TD Legal because I saw the opportunity. So that's, we have something in common, Nathan. I don't know if you're aware, but we both worked at the bank. You were at TD Bank, and back then it was Canada Trust. It was 40 years ago.
I was a much lower position though. I was a teller for a little bit, and then I was a financial services rep in the branch.
Yeah. Oh,
I didn't make it very high.
Yeah.
I jumped into policing early.
And we did the same job. So I was customer service. I was back then you were allowed to sell mutual funds.
Yeah.
Back then. So but funny enough, TD Insurance was not around in the 80s. So they only became TD Insurance later on. But I worked, actually got a great opportunity to work at TD Legal. So TD Legal was the in-house legal for the insurance side of our insurance division. And I'll shout out to some great leaders there. So Eric Sigerson was my direct, I actually reported to him directly. And Suzanne Cortlander, who is now actually, she was at TD and she's now with Gore Mutual. She was instrumental because I learned a lot from Suzanne. I was actually placed as an operations manager, and we did across Canada law firm visits. I oversaw with Suzanne, I think there were about 120 lawyers and clerks, assistants, paralegals.
Okay.
So learning the legal side. So I already had that experience in with working at CAA Insurance and State Farm, but understanding the start to finish of a legal suit and lawsuit was extremely important for me and understanding how it applies to insurance fraud. So because you're denying cases so it's really interesting. But then from there, I actually got, crazy enough, I got asked by a former detective from Toronto Police to think about becoming a consultant. And at that time, to be honest, I was a single mom and my daughter was in university. And I didn't know whether or not I could manage coming out of out of the corporate world, earning a salary to become an entrepreneur. But I did it. And that's when I met Frank Cacciuzzola from W3 Intelligence Research Group. And Frank's the founder of the investigation firm. And the reason why I'm working with W3 is because they specialize in OSINT, so open source and social media investigations. Primarily, we work with insurance companies for any type of claim, whether it be the bodily injury, the accident benefits, the special investigation, or even a legal case. So I've never seen intelligence like the way W3 puts together an investigation. So that's how I came to become a consultant, and but still collaborating. Like a lot of my having the opportunity of being a consultant, you're able to knock on any door. So
yeah, I see some of the posts that you put up on social media and like some of the events that you're either attending or you've spoken at. Like you can see you have quite a breadth of, I guess, organizations that you've worked with, mm-hmm. but different topics that you've spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty impressive.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I guess this would be a good spot to get on with also what we were talking about just off air about some of the myths maybe around the insurance industry, some of the overlap with law enforcement, some of the stuff we were speaking to a bit earlier. I was going to jump in, but I was like, I'll let you go. Cause I think there's a lot of stuff that comes up where people, we'll say the clients that we deal with right from fibbing a little bit mm-hmm. about how bad their situation might be to just outright fraud and lying. But are there any myths or things you want to set straight about the insurance industry that maybe people don't know?
Yeah, I'm going to be very honest. I think the general public have a viewpoint of insurance. Many don't like insurance companies. Similar to, your law enforcement sector, there are individuals that are jaded by law enforcement or insurance. But in actual fact, insurance companies are there to protect the policyholder. And yes, they're paying claims that are legitimate, but they will investigate those claims that are not legitimate. And they have to, because they have to answer to the stakeholder,
yeah.
which is us, who are policyholders. And I think it's important to understand the complexity of how many different departments there are within the insurance company, how many people are hands-on with, one file that could be a fraud file or stage loss, and the amount of people that are involved in order to investigate. And then our resources are FSRA, which is fiscal back in the day. And I'm going to touch on just when we were handling cases, when I was handling the special investigations unit at CAA, that was really important time in 2005 where we were getting hit. So it was extremely important to investigate these type of losses because the clinics, there were a number of clinics, bad actors, I would say, that were defrauding. And when you get a clinic involved, they need people to come to their clinic so that they can bill out for it.
Okay.
And these billings were actually fraudulent.
So we're talking a medical clinic?
Yes.
Okay.
It could be a rehabilitation clinic. And I'll just put out there, the major one that the Insurance Bureau of Canada did basically investigated with all the insurers. So I think there were six of us that were on for this type of fraud. But if you look at Project Whiplash, that was a huge case where over $4 million was defrauded from the insurance companies. There were, I believe, I'm just going to reference, 37 people were actually arrested.
Wow.
130. Yeah. And this wasn't just one. Project Whiplash wasn't just, you know, the four clinics. This was going on across Canada and typically probably across all the globally, because people were coached and trained on how to submit a false claim.
That's what I was going to say is all these bad guys share ideas. It's not isolated to just a small area. Yeah. It's 100%. It's across the board.
Yeah. The forums, right?
Yeah.
There's forums that actually, you know, people learn on how to defraud. And that's where you get Project Whiplash was basically staged losses. So just having the resources like the Insurance Bureau of Canada, Equité today, which is really instrumental for combating the fraud piece of it, but making the arrests. And that's where we need our law enforcement partners to prosecute. So,
yeah.
And it's been going on for a while, but back in the mid 2000s, I would say that historically that was a pivotal time for insurance industries, because we were getting hit by not only organized crime, but various mafias that were taking advantage of the soft crime that they could commit.
Did you ever find a link, or do you know of this ever happening where maybe organized crime gets a normal everyday person who might not be a criminal to go in and make a false claim? They split the money kind of thing. Is there any kind of crossover, or was it organized crime kind of stayed in their box and then you had people just making their individual fraudulent claims?
Yeah, both.
Both? Okay.
Yeah. And you would see the name. So what's happening, Nathan, is that a clinic will get shut down by FSRA. There might be lawyers involved. There might be accountants involved. So their association will address them and investigate them through, for instance, the Law Society of Canada. So you got a lot of associations that are attached to this one particular investigation that maybe six or seven insurance companies are dealing with and are being targeted. But you also have your other insurance companies that may not even be aware that they have been targeted by this type of fraud, and they just paid the claim. And we see this continuously up until today in our investigations at W3.
Did the insurance companies at this time, so we're talking like early, mid-2000s, did they ever talk to one another? Is there like a central database? Because, and I asked that just because I've recently, I think it was somebody had some kind of collision that I was investigating, and I ended up talking with an insurance company out of that. I said, you know, is it easy if somebody just, say they cancel their vehicle insurance over here with company A, can they just go to company B and company B has no clue what this person's done? They said that there is a centralized database now where you can't necessarily just jump from company to company. Like they do talk, or it's like over a certain period, kind of an audit happens on a person. Every 2 to 3 years, I think they were saying. And, if they don't catch you right off the bat, 2 years, 3 years, maybe something kind of comes back up from your history, your insurance history. So
yeah,
was there that kind of collaboration before?
Yeah, no, and it's still ongoing. So it's basically through various, I would say, portals, you can get information like for your VIN searches, for your motor vehicle accidents in the past, your driver's abstract. So similar to what law enforcement is extracting for their investigations, where you're getting, you're going to your MTOs or your Service Ontarios for request of information. So we have the ability to access on the insurance side, speaking for on behalf of insurers, to see a history of accidents, and other like through a driver's abstract.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to see who was on for a previous loss and the duration of that loss through like an auto plus.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Is there interprovincial collaboration? I know that's an issue that police have. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily talk across provincial lines very well. So what's it like on the insurance side?
Yeah, I don't think that's happening, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, there's a number of provinces that are publicly funded too, so or government funded. But
yes.
ICBC and other provinces. But I think what happens is typically you, as an adjuster, you'll figure out there's a couple red flags on the file. And that's when pretty much the investigation starts. And they'll hire a private firm like ours, where we do the open source and social media investigation. And that's where haven't seen that historically working in insurance, that you need the intelligence firsthand before you do any type of covert surveillance. So we, you know, very similar to law enforcement, covert surveillance is also implemented, but you have to have your intelligence before. You need to understand, you know, who the individual is, and what we're seeing is quite a bit of information as well. So it's, and having the expertise to locate information is really key.
So just before jumping on the W3 side, mm-hmm. On the insurance side of things, when they do an investigation, where do their powers to do an investigation, to hold people accountable, where does that all come from? And also, like you're talking about surveillance, one of the things when you're saying like some of these clinics were getting shut down, I instantly was thinking, do insurance companies have UCs? They have people doing undercover. So not that I'm looking to reveal any techniques, but do they have different units within insurance companies like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's just say when you are signing up for insurance and you have a claim, you're actually signing documents that you're going to submit a claim that's true, mm-hmm. And you're not going to falsify the information. So we have the Insurance Act where there is a section that we have the opportunity to investigate. So
okay.
Which allows us, or kind of gives us the ability, the ability to investigate. So you have your first line adjusters, claims professionals who are actually capable of investigating a loss, you know, and whether it be a statement that they need to go out and take or an examination under oath before it even gets to legal. So they have to make a determination whether or not the claim is legitimate or not, or they have to provide a position on their whether or not they're going to cover that claim. So, and then they can hire, and obviously it's best to hire a private firm so that there are no biases when it comes to the investigation.
Okay.
That's, you know, something that's what we do is basically provide an investigation report to them. And then from that point, they make decisions on utilizing that as evidence if they were to go to trial.
So they would. So if you're an insurance company, you would hire W3. They would go do an investigation, kind of come back with the findings. Mm-hmm. And I'm just summarizing here. So to help, jump in if I'm totally wrong. They would come back with the findings, and then the insurance company essentially has a decision to make whether they want to go report to police and say, hey, there's something criminal going on here, we have a fraud or whatever it might be, or I guess they can go after you civilly on that side of things as well.
Mm, yeah.
If they're looking to recoup money.
Yeah.
So is that the general flow of an investigation?
Yeah, so typically, and there are a lot of layers to it. It's not as simple as making that decision. It has to go through authority as well, you know, through a leadership review. Legal may be involved in overseeing that decision before the decision's actually delivered to the individual. And I'm going to reference a suspicious claim. And then at that point, so back in the day, it used to be the Insurance Bureau of Canada that we would actually go to. And FSRA would also be a part of that too. But now we have Equitate, who has a membership of, I believe it's 20 insurers. So that's an association that they can go to as well. And then from that point, then it's all up to the insurance company to make the decision on whether or not they're going to be proceeding with criminal charges and bringing it to law enforcement. But ideally, law enforcement would like to see it packaged.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, it's otherwise, they don't have the manpower to handle these type of insurance cases, and it's too complex.
Yeah, well, some of these investigations grow tentacles, and it's just an explosion. You're like, all of a sudden, we've got 30 people who've been defrauded. Now there's 30 statements I got to take, and I got to go to all these places, and the production orders. I hate writing production orders. So right. When you start getting into all those and search warrants, like it just takes so much, so many resources and a lot of people on it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, you're kind of looking at the outcome. What are we going to get in the end? I guess to apologize on behalf of law enforcement and maybe the criminal justice system hasn't been holding up its end of the bargain lately with convictions and keeping bad guys in jail. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that's quite a fascinating way or how the investigations work. Mm-hmm. I had no clue about a lot of this stuff. And it almost sounds like policing, just minus all the bodily fluids and people fighting you, and you don't carry a firearm. So it's about the only differences so far. Now you're with W3, mm-hmm. and with them, and I was asking this off air, so you're a consultant there, mm-hmm. and that allows you a lot of kind of space to roam around, mm-hmm. consult with a lot of different companies. What do you find, like, what's your day-to-day like? Who, you know, what does your job entail at this point?
So definitely strategizing with our clients, for sure, just on what we're seeing on the investigation side. And it could be typically an investigation comes in from an insurance company. And like I said, there could be a lawsuit going on and a dispute, an element of embellishment or fraud. So we would do the investigation. I actually do the analysis just based on my experience, and then we provide the report to the insurance companies. So it's not only insurers that we work with, we also work with defense counsel, because what's key, Nathan, is that, as you mentioned, your production order, you got to make sure that the defense is set up appropriately well before an examination under oath or a examination for discovery.
Yeah.
So if they're asking, if they don't have information of that, you know, there may be a shell company that this individual actually owns, or there's some relationship to a tow operator or a clinic where, you know, there's a connectivity, I think they're not going to be in a better position to position their questions at discovery or request for affidavit of documents. So we highly recommend that when an insurance company is considering investigations for open source and social media, that they do it well before an examination for discovery.
Okay.
Yeah, it gets into the legal stuff of it, but we won't go into that because it's too complex. Mm-hmm. But the outcome is, you know, is the insurance company on for this claim? Is it legitimate or is it not? So, and if it's, the insurance companies pretty much know, they know when there's a legitimate claim.
Yeah.
It starts seeing the red flags and, you know, certain things that I never knew about human trafficking, to be honest. And I think we had a slight conversation about this before, is that when I started working for W3 and having the opportunity to understand what human trafficking, now, not only human trafficking, with respect to, sex trafficking, but also for labor trafficking.
Yeah.
There, a lot of that is going on in the insurance industry that insurance professionals are not aware of. And an eye opener was for me. I had a meeting with one of my insurance clients, and I was sitting in the lobby, and two people showed up, and they were at the front desk waiting for their adjuster to come to meet with them. The one person that was standing beside them, the tall gentleman, was not allowed to speak. And that's typically what happens. So when there's a claim that goes out there, that's very suspicious when someone of a, you know, just an acquaintance or a family member is representing that individual and speaking on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And then when you find out that this person's actually capable of speaking the English language, you have to kind of question what's going on. And that happens a lot. And that for me is human trafficking.
And just to kind of clarify for myself mostly, because I don't have a clue, but also for the audience, like how does the insurance, or sorry, how does human trafficking come into the insurance industry? Like what type of claims are they making? Is this just around the labor side of things, or could this have to do with sex trafficking? Because there's a lot of things that are encompassed in the whole human trafficking aspect. So yeah. What are they making claims on?
So let's just go from the start of a staged loss. You got individuals who there could be three people in one vehicle and three or four people in another vehicle. They are positioned there so that the accident is staged. Either it's a, you know, a fender bender, or the vehicles have been damaged prior and they're in the vehicle. So back in the day, police used to attend the scene, and now they go to the collision reporting center.
Yeah.
So those people would go to the collision reporting center and report that they had an injury, or an ambulance is called. So these individuals are being used, and I can actually say or refer to the word mules.
Yeah.
So that the person who is orchestrating the fraud can submit their claims on their behalf, and they will get benefits, income replacement benefits. They will get medical benefits. So now you got, you know, a tow truck that shows up at the scene, provides a physiotherapy card or rehabilitation clinic card, and now they're going to that clinic. They may not attend, they may not show up for treatment, and that's what we're seeing in the, you know, it happens historically, but I'll refer back to Project Whiplash, was basically blank treatment plan treatment invoices. So
okay.
You have a they would sign their name beside that they showed up for treatment, but there was never any treatment that was incurred. Hmm. So they never got the treatment. So then you have a treatment center that is actually exploiting and defrauding the insurance company. So it's someone's getting a benefit, someone's getting whether it be orthotics, that's another fraudulent claim, or it could be treatment. There's so many aspects of insurance fraud. It's but that's the person. They need people or individuals to be in that car accident. But what happens is that they may be in one car one time, and then it's just they repeat the case. So then the claim is with a different insurer, different vehicle.
Yeah.
And they have a number of claims going on. So sometimes you'll see that an individual may have, you know, historically about 20 claims.
So that's where you need the cross collaboration, where it's like, okay, I can see your history in whatever province with whatever insurer. Mm. And look, all the exact same details. It's crazy.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that you have to treat it that every claim is legitimate. So you can't just go out and deny a claim. So you have to have your investigation completed. A lot of these individuals who are sitting in those vehicles are literally going on with life, and they are, they're back at work. And that's where our investigations reveal that I would say about 85 to 90% are not legitimate.
Yeah.
On our investigation. Yeah.
Well, even when you're talking about orthotics. I'm thinking, isn't that like $300? It's like a $300 claim or maybe $500. It's just people are lying everywhere.
And then, yeah.
Like I feel like even as police, you know, you get kind of, you're a little guarded with people in general. And maybe a little more suspicious than the average person might be. The average person might just, you know, kind of give their name out or say personal information. Whereas police, you're always like, oh, what's your motive? And do you find it, doing the things that you've been, you know, that you've done, that being through those kind of investigations, are you a little more on the police side of thinking?
Yeah. And that's, I think, you have to handle every case with open eyes. You have to be unbiased. Have to, even though you see, you know, even variations of names, and that's what's happening with that identity changes. Like we're dealing with a whole other area where these individuals, they may have one name, but then the next year they have a different name, or they have, obviously in law enforcement, you're dealing with alias names. We're dealing with the, kind of the same thing, but private side, and you guys are on the public side. So that, I think you have to, I'm always cautious about how, when we open up a file and we treat it, in an unbiased manner, but in open source and social media, it's going to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And the individual is going to be, like I said, I would say 90% of our cases are showing that cases are not legitimate.
Yeah. I think, you know what, I think there's a healthy amount of bias. Mm-hmm. And I know they make us take a lot of courses on you know, watching our bias or not having any or whatever they want to call it. Bias is what keeps a lot of people alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and I guess you could extend that to companies. It keeps companies alive because if you didn't have any, if you never questioned anything and just thought the best of everybody in the world, you'd have no money. And you'd give all your stuff away. So I think there's a healthy amount of bias because it's needed to stay alive. But yeah, definitely when you're still going to, but as a professional, you're still going to carry out the investigation, do the investigative steps and show that, you know, I did the best I could with the information I had.
Exactly.
This is what it looks like in the end.
Yeah.
And you kind of let it lie wherever it ends up. It's also why there's the separation, right? Of, you have your judges to make the decision. So one of the things I was wondering too is, do you as W3, do you have the power to compel anything from anybody? So, you know, do you write any type of production orders or is most of an investigation kind of what you see, what you hear, but you're not necessarily interacting or is there kind of a middle ground in there?
Yeah, no, as the investigation is conducted, we are only harvesting the intelligence. And then we compile information, provide it to the insurance company. From there, they make decisions based on the findings. And then if legal, their defense counsel is involved, that's when the production requests come in. So that comment that I made, it's preparing your legal to ensure that they have the right information to request any type of document. And any type of document can be, you know, it can be a business that is unknown to the insurance company. It could be it could be really anything, Nathan. So it's very similar to law enforcement. It's at that point you're preparing your file for or your case for a trial.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll kind of get onto the social media aspect of things. And when you're talking about OSINT and some of these aspects to conducting these investigations, are you seeing any trends out there? And is, you know, how powerful, can you, I guess, explain for people how powerful of a tool this is? Because when I think from my side of things, some people are kind of smart and don't put their whole life on social media. But other people, they put everything. They won't tell you, you know, they'll get mad if I write down their name that's on their driver's license that I could have searched from their license plate anyways or something. But I can just bring up your name on Facebook and I can see that you got this many kids and your wife and, you know, I can see your whole life. So it's kind of strange. But what are you seeing on your side with the open source and social media? How powerful of a tool is this?
Yeah, and that's why I'm happy to be with W3. And historically, I've never seen this type of intelligence before. So you're going to get everything in, you know, whether it be deep web, dark web, or just typically your social media platforms. So whatever that person has out there, it's pretty much information and intelligence. Mm. Typically, some people don't put any information in their social media platforms, or they have their privacy settings enabled. But there is information out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're able to operate on the dark web as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think I had one person on before that talked a little bit about that. Yeah, that's a whole nother aspect though. There's quite a fascinating perspective on people there. I want to ask about your partnerships with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
You do some speaking engagements with law enforcement. You were mentioning some students that you have.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think for me, it's collaboration is really key. We're going to all learn. We shouldn't be siloed. So there, you know, within insurance, there's a lot of silos because of PIPEDA. We can't, you know, on the insurance side, they can't really talk to one another. They have to protect the policyholder. The same goes with law enforcement. There's silos within law enforcement too. I see such an opportunity to strategize, but it can't be a one-way street. It has to be a collaboration that we will benefit from each other, whether it be, say, for instance, W3, providing a small agency, a police agency that don't have the skill set in open source. And we could provide that type of investigation or intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's available, the information's available. And now, similar to insurance professionals, they'll have that information available to them as to how they are going to navigate on, you know, pressing charges or looking for certain individuals or connectivity to, you know, it might be an auto theft, but it's actually, there's an element of mortgage fraud. So we're able to provide, and we're seeing that in our intelligence gathering. And I think that's where the gaps need to be closed, because at the end of the day, it's about public safety. And if we're not protecting the public or the consumer, we're just spending money. We're just, there's so many people. Yeah, it's crazy how there's so many different leaderships within decision makers. The teams now, and I'm talking both law enforcement and insurance. So if we kind of collaborate, or we do collaborate, then the more information, the faster the arrest, and the less fraud that's going to go on. I think that's how I see it playing out.
Yeah.
So for me, it's key on just building that. But on your comment with respect to students, so I'm a huge advocate to training those who are very interested in developing their skill set. So it could be just mentoring various students. And I am currently mentoring with Seneca College right now.
Okay.
But I get a lot of requests on LinkedIn from even law enforcement. They have their kids who are looking to get into various occupations, and they just want to have like a chat with me to kind of gear them in a direction that they may not be aware of. So I'm open to mentorships, and I love the fact that our younger generation are so skilled at what they do. They have a lot of opportunity out there, and I take myself back all the way to being in the law enforcement program at Seneca in the 80s, not knowing that there is so much opportunity out there.
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, I would love for anyone to just reach out and just say, can we have a quick chat? And I'm always available for, you know, a 10, 15 minute call for sure.
Oh, that's very cool. And paying it forward, right? And yeah. You talk about all the mentors that you had, and
yeah.
We don't want to kind of leave the next generation just languishing and not help them out. I think it's very good that we're able to have these partnerships, kind of speaking to the police side of things and partnering with outside agencies. This is something that I've been harping on a little bit more with the latest set of podcasts and talking about having those partnerships, because the police can't do it all. I understand that there are security concerns. Mm-hmm. So how are these other outside agencies, you know, vetting people or security clearing them? Mm-hmm. And I think those are all things that if somebody just put their mind to it, or a group of people put their mind to it, they could come up with some ways. I mean, you know, the military partners with local people in all kinds of countries. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the police can partner with people in their own country.
Yeah.
But I think there's a fear of doing that. Maybe there's like a few different aspects to that comment, where I think it's just in the fear of it. I think there's a fear of saying, hey, the police can't do something and we need help.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there's also the fear that maybe resources get taken away from police, because we always need more, mm-hmm. but so do a lot of other people.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I just think with the way things are going in this world, especially when you talk about frauds, the organized crime, they have specialists all over in every single industry. And as police, we're in a lot of respects generalists.
Mm-hmm.
And we need more of that expertise. If we can hire somebody outside to, you know, go and do a certain portion of an investigation, I just think it makes sense.
Yeah.
But again, I'm also not I'm not a chief or deputy chief. I don't know. Maybe these conversations are happening. I'm not privy to them, but
I hope. Yeah.
Do you see anything kind of coming up like that? Like, do you see more police services reaching out? Is there more of that kind of extending of the olive branch and saying, hey, we need help with things?
Mm-hmm. I did actually, this is back to 2020 when I actually was collaborating with the Insurance Bureau of Canada specifically on auto theft and break and enters at that time. And look at where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, when I was doing, you know, just, I would just contact various law enforcement agencies. And I met up with two intelligence detectives at Toronto Police, and they actually saw the value in what we do. And like you said, it depends on the level of decision makers to see the value. So am I talking to the wrong people? I'm not sure, but I know that they see value in what we do on the intelligence side of things. I actually left the division. I barely got to my car, Nathan, and an email was sent out by this detective to approximately 120 people. And then we're talking across the board,
wow.
Various sectors in automotive, insurance, financial, you name it. And basically summed up our meeting that we had. So I knew that I was in the right direction on speaking to various law enforcement agencies. But I do understand and I appreciate the silo and the privacy issue. I do get that. But I just think if we're going to close that gap, we have to align. Because like I said, there's other agencies that don't benefit from experts like in social media and open source.
Yeah.
And there's so much to talk about that I would love to share with respect to even on the gang side.
Mm-hmm.
And how much information we were able to provide. And it's literally offering the police information, but we have to work together. That's, you know,
yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise I think 99% of my time will be free. So, you know what I mean? I have to do my work as well, but I think it's important that, that we just start to close that gap and bring the intelligence together so that we can make these arrests. And like I said, it's across the board because insurance, when I'll just leave on or finalize on a message. Mm-hmm. When you think of anything, insurance touches it. So you got a car, you have a policy, you have a house, you have a policy, you have a business, you have a policy. And if there's any type of element of crime, that's where I think we're missing the opportunity to investigate together. Because if the insurance company is not aware that there's an investigation going on with drug trafficking, and where are they, you know, they need a building in order to,
yeah,
to, you know, store their drugs or their money, the money that they've laundered, or their guns. Gun trafficking across the border, it's coming through on a vehicle. So how many times have we missed the opportunity to bring the insurance company in to investigate with them?
Yeah, well, stop people from getting some of this insurance and putting their names on, you know, 600 vehicles. It's like, oh, this starts to look a little funny.
Yes. Exactly.
So, you know what? Yeah, I think that's a great place to wrap up. I think this discussion, one of the benefits of it is, you know, for especially for law enforcement listening, but anybody in general, just look outside of your organization or the box that you're in and look for partnerships and see where you can be creative and reach out to some of those people and say, hey, you know, I'm dealing with this vehicle for whatever the reason might be. Are you interested in any of this information? Would this help us help you and also help stop some crime that's going on out there? There's many more discussions to be had. So we'll definitely have to chat again. Just at the end here, I want to make sure you get a chance to say how people can connect with you. You're saying reach out, but where can they find you?
Mm-hmm. Definitely for on LinkedIn, for sure. That's my favorite spot. There is a massive community of experts that we are connected right now. And there's a lot of support on even a number of my posts, which I'm really grateful for. So LinkedIn for myself, for a W3 Intelligence Research Group, it's www.w3irg.com. And they also, W3 has a LinkedIn page as well. I really highly, highly suggest just please connect on LinkedIn. Whenever I'm doing conferences, international conferences, or even national conferences, I really encourage that we start building this community of experts. And that goes for the AML industry too. I've done a lot of meetings with my banking friends too. Yeah. So they're unsuspecting of our insurance fraud because they see it as a clean money that's coming through, when in fact it's not. So yeah, highly encourage that connection.
Awesome. Well, I'll remind people to like, subscribe, share The Quiet Professional.
Yes.
Get a hold of Liz if you're looking for some help or have questions with any of this stuff. I'll put the links up in the episode description. And that was an awesome conversation.
Thank you.
If you want to hang on the line for 2 seconds, I'll say bye offline. But thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you, Nathan.